I have decided, Mike, that I really, really, really like the 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Yeah?
Yes. This morning, I was editing videos because my life revolves around video right now. And I had 2 hours worth of recorded video that I needed to encode with this machine. You want to take a crack at how long it took to do that 2 hours?
About 100 times less than it would have taken you on your previous computer?
Yes, significantly. Now, there's a lot that goes into this, but it took 10 minutes to encode that 2 hours.
Yeah, it's a screaming machine for sure.
I was beside myself. I thought that, you know, historically, that would have taken me about 2 hours to get the encoding completed. So to have it in 10 minutes is just astounding. I love this thing. Just love, love, love it.
And it features a keyboard that actually works.
Yes, it has an escape key.
Right.
I don't know if you know that or not, but it has an escape key that I'm quite thrilled about.
I don't use it like you programmers do, but I know that probably makes you very happy.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Absolutely thrilled. Probably way more than I should be. Faux show. Now, I want to jump into follow-up here, Mike, but you have to do it in a specific order per the outline, okay?
All right.
I want you to do number three, and then your choice of one and two back and forth, but number three has to come first.
Okay. So the true follow-up here is on my action item to create a stop doing list. I did not do this. In fact, I went kind of completely against this.
Okay.
The goal of this item was to stop doing things. And different time, different place, I probably would have done that. We are in the middle of this self-quarantine thing. Everybody's responding to this a little bit differently. My response apparently is to make things.
Yep.
So instead of choosing things to stop doing, I made two new things since we recorded last. The first one is a new course on the Suite Setup on the topic of time blocking, which was something that I floated by Sean not too long ago. Said, hey, what do you think about this idea? Because one of the things I love about working with Sean and the rest of the team at the Suite Setup, but Sean specifically, he's the one who sets the tone for the company. From the very beginning of this, he said that he doesn't want to be tone deaf to what's going on in the world, and he wants to authentically help people, which is evidenced by giving away the time management course. And that happened during my last sabbatical, so it was really cool to see that happen. Like, that was really encouraging to me that, you know, I'm in the right place. These are my people.
Sure. Yeah.
And so when I floated the idea of the time blocking course, it was based off of, you know, I've had several people who have reached out to me and asking for some help with this time blocking thing, which I tend to talk a lot about. And one person in particular, our buddy Josh, asked me if I knew of any good resources. I'm like, you know, I really don't. Cal Newport's got some old blog posts from 2013, which talk about this, which were inspiring to me. And I kind of synthesized my own system off of this, but I don't know of anything that I could just send people to. So I made something.
Hey, that works.
with a lot of help from Isaac and the rest of the team at the Suite Setup. So I want to clarify that. But if you download the course, you'll hear my voice. You'll see my face. So, but it is definitely a team effort. But yeah, it's really five videos on the basics of time blocking, some tips and tricks, how to do it, and then a video on how to do it in Fantastical and a video on how to do it in GoodNotes. So it's a fun course. I think it's a very timely course, and it's a very affordable course at $29. Actually, right now, as we record this, it's $23. I'm not sure if that launch price is still going to be available when this episode goes live, but even so, it's not a huge investment. We did a webinar yesterday for it. If that is up by the time this publishes, I'll include a link to the replay. Fun course to do. It's talking head videos that I shot at home myself. First time I ever did that sort of thing.
Nice.
But it turned out pretty well. I'm not sure if you've looked at the contents of the course because I just sent it to you this morning, but
right.
I'm really happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, I haven't actually hit play on any of the videos yet, but I was queuing things up because I need more things to do.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I'm bored and need time fillers.
Sure.
But no, it was it looked like it was a really cool course. I'm excited to go through it because it's the exact thing that I need help with right now, Mike. So I'm excited that you made something to help.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing is, you know, that was the authentic reasoning behind creating it was, I don't know of anything like this out there. I wish that something like this existed. Let's make it and let's make it affordable because this is what people need right now.
Right.
So
cool.
So that's thing number one. Thing number two is I launched another podcast with my wife, and it is called The Intentional Family. It is something that we've been talking about for a long time. Kind of the inspiration for this is we have been doing this sort of stuff with our family for years where we have these different systems. I've talked about a lot of them on Bookworm specifically, like the family core values and stuff like that. And every time that people come over and they see the stuff on our walls, like the pie charts and things like that, they see it and they're like, so what's the deal with that? You know, and then we explain it and they're like, oh, that's awesome. I want to steal that. And we're like, go ahead. So we don't profess to have everything figured out, but we do know some things that work, at least for us. So we wanted to share that on a larger scale. Especially now, you know, that was kind of the thing that got this out the door was people were reaching out to us and asking for advice on, hey, I'm homeschooling now. What should I do? Or kind of time blocking was part of this too. Like, okay, now everything has changed. My family's home with me. I'm still trying to work remotely. Like how do I make this work? So, we believe we've got something to share, and we started a podcast, which is going to be real. The plan is every other week, although we have so many ideas, we may for a while start doing it weekly. And they're going to be shorter 30-minute episodes. So kind of the anti-bookworm, if you will.
Yeah. A little bit quicker than what we pull off.
Yeah. And the reason for that, I think that when you're talking about stuff that you want to implement with multiple people, it's important that you keep it simple. It really, you can't make broad sweeping changes with your family if you have multiple members that you're trying to coordinate and all go in the same direction. So we want to give people little things that they can do, little adjustments. And so that's kind of a forced constraint for us not to go too deep on any single topic. And if we do, stretch it out over multiple episodes so people have time to think through the things and figure out how to apply it to their family situation.
Sure.
So that is at intentionalfamily.fm. It's also on Apple Podcasts. I assume it's an Overcast. I haven't looked for it there yet. But go subscribe if that sounds of interest to you.
I already did. Thrilled to death.
Hey, thanks.
I feel like this is something I have wanted to exist for a long time. There are a few like family-oriented podcasts that I have attempted to listen to in the past, but always struggle to because I feel like the co-hosts are not exactly, how do I say that? They're not exactly easy to listen to. So I'm glad that you and Rachel are doing this. I'm really glad that Rachel's doing one now.
Yeah, exactly. So this is her baby. I introduced the first episode and in the introduction, I said, you know, I am the co-host. Rachel is the host. And I'm doing this just because I have some podcast experience. But from here on out, you know, she's running the show.
Sure.
And that's because she has a lot to share. I do too, but I have other places that I can talk about stuff.
Right, right.
In a yet-to-be-released episode of Focused, as we record this anyways, talking to David about this, he said, glad I'm not the only one who doesn't have a single unpublished thought. You know, yeah. I'm quickly trending to that category, but this is I don't know, people can hear me talk about stuff multiple places and you probably get sick of just another podcast about what Mike Schmitz has to say, but turns out, you know, my wife is actually amazing and the secret to a lot of my success, so she's going to talk about it from her perspective, and more importantly, I think, is the dynamic that we have in leading the family together. It's not something that one person can do. It takes both people. And so again, not saying that we have it all figured out. A lot of people know a lot more about this than we do, but we want to share what we do know and hopefully help some people who are looking for some answers right now.
Sure. I think this is perfect time to be releasing something like this because there are so many people stuck with no one but their family. So it's good timing. Well done, Mike. Good job, Rachel. Really excited.
Yeah. And the other thing about this that's interesting to me is that we don't know when things go back to normal, but the time that you have right now with your family doesn't have to be a negative thing. We had a family meeting day one and said, you know, this could be awesome or this could be really annoying. It's up to you guys and your perspective. Yeah, we can't do some of the stuff that we liked to do, but we can still have fun together. And we've been able to do that largely as a family. Right before we recorded here, we had a playing lightning out in the driveway with the entire family on the basketball hoop that you saw via FaceTime.
Nice.
You know, so little things like that really make a big difference. And I feel that if you are stuck home with your family, the things that you do now are going to echo years from now. The seeds that you plant right now will produce a harvest when things go back to normal. And I think it's really important for families specifically to recognize that you have an opportunity here.
For sure. No, I think this is a good one. I haven't listened to the first one, but I have it. And I am subscribed. So, yes, I'm excited about this one. Good call, Rachel, if you're listening. Good job. Excited.
All right, enough talking about me and my failed action item.
I was going to say, this is kind of like the entirety of your follow-up is, I failed. But here's all the cool stuff I'm making because I failed.
I failed gloriously.
Oh, well done, Mike. Good job. Well, I have a single action item here, which is simply a question. How do I apply great thinking to my online business? And this is coming from Good to Great. And I'll be honest and admit that I did not spend 1 second thinking about this over the last 2 weeks. Apologies. Not even an attempt. I think it's a cool idea, but I don't have anything.
Yeah, I am tempted to just say, let's forget all the action items until we're done with this thing, along with all the gap books. But the action items do come out from reading the book, though. So
right.
I guess it's worth still talking about them, even if our success rate is going to go down significantly.
Yep. I think it's continuing to go, at least for me, it's continuing to go down. I feel like I would be interested to see like the success rate of action items from the time we started the Bookworm podcast to right now. I would venture to say that there's a much lower success rate now than there was at the beginning. That's my speculation.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, right now, just because of where everybody finds themselves, it's going to be lower. In the webinar yesterday with Sean, I encouraged him to share this and he talked about it. And I think it was really important and for a lot of people to realize that there's maybe this unset expectation right now that you're working from home, you don't have your commute, you don't have all these other things, all these other distractions, if you will. So think about all the time that you have and how productive you can be. You're not going to be productive. I've seen a lot of articles being published lately about stop trying to be productive during all of this.
Right.
And I think that's an important attitude to have. Sean shared in the webinar yesterday that on his best day, he's at about 75% effectiveness. And I'm glad that he shared that in the webinar because then I could share it here because I totally agree with that. He said on some days it's more like 50, but on his best days it's like 75. So you're not going to get as much done as you were getting done before. Just because things are different and there's a whole bunch of other factors that are weighing on you, subconsciously maybe even, you don't even realize how emotionally drained you are from all of this stuff. So cut yourself a break, cut everybody that you work with a break. You know, if they're not getting things done, not getting things to you in the way that they normally do, everybody's trying to figure this out on the fly.
Yes, yes, and yes. I will say, like, I have more time, but it's all being used up by my jobby job. So there's that, which is why like I've had a few people email me recently, like, Joe, where's your newsletter been? Where's your blog post? I'm like, I don't have time. Like, I just don't. Thankfully, as of like this weekend, like coming into this next Monday, like it drops off significantly for me because we finally started to hit a stride this week. So I feel like I'm in pretty good shape after this. So my goal is to write something in the following week, but this episode will have released by then. So it'll be kind of weird. Sorry. That'll be strange. But That's where I land. I've spent no time thinking about the question I was supposed to spend time thinking about, and I am not planning to do that. Confession.
That's all right. We forgive you.
All right. Let's jump into today's book, which is The Antidote by Oliver Berkman. Happiness for people who can't stand positive thinking. And I have to admit that as I was reading this, I feel like this is the antithesis to a lot of the books that we've read on Bookworm.
It is. Yep.
I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but it feels like he is going through the process of picking apart a lot of the self-help theories one by one and showing why they are wrong and showing why you need to do the exact opposite. I think that's my
summary
of the
book. Well, he's attempting to show why they're wrong.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, that's a very good clarification to make. Thank you for that, Mike.
Yeah.
I think I just figured out what your opinion of the book is.
I struggle with this. So at a broad level, before we get into the specific contents, I feel like there's a lot to be mined from this book, but the way that it's written is trying to address a whole bunch of things in a short chapter, sprinkle in some personal stories, and as a result, there's not really a deep conversation around any one of these things. Just as an example, later on in the book, he talks about Carol Dweck and mindset, fixed versus growth mindset. He calls it fixed theory and incremental theory, but it's he quotes Carol Dweck specifically, and there's a whole book on that topic, which speaks to it much more clearly and has a lot more value, in my opinion, than the two-page section in here. And that's like one selective point that he's using to support the argument laid out at the very beginning of this chapter. And I feel like a lot of the stuff that he uses in here is that selective picking and choosing of things that will support his argument without looking at them in totality to see what they support and what they don't support. So if you read this at surface level, you kind of feel like these things tie together. But it, to me, because I've read enough of these books, maybe I feel like it's tied together very loosely. And if you look closely at any one of these, you start to see where things are falling apart at the seams in the patchwork of his arguments. Is that fair?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I feel like there were a number of times he was making an argument and I wondered, am I just falling into the positive thinking trap, as he would refer to it, or is he actually full of it? I kept asking that question to myself quite a bit.
And that is not to say that I agree or disagree with anything. That's just based on like how the book itself is put together. So maybe that should be more author style in rating, but I think it's important to call out here at the beginning, because as we go through all of these things, these are very selective in how they are presented. So there is definitely a bias here, starting with the very first story where he talks about being at the Get Motivated event and how he's standing next to this guy who is basically heckling from the outer rim, like way up in the nosebleeds, and thinking that this is ridiculous. That's kind of the framework for the rest of the book, is this whole industry is like this. And I don't think it's all like that. I think there are people that are like that. And I don't like those types of events either. I was offered the opportunity to go to a Tony Robbins event for free, and I'm like, nah, I don't really want to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though I think that Tony Robbins does a lot of good. If you follow his life story at all, and like the Money Book specifically, someone showed up at his house on Thanksgiving Day when his parents couldn't afford a Thanksgiving dinner and they were arguing about it, and someone delivered them a Thanksgiving dinner, and that made an impact on him. So he gave out, I forget the number, but it's thousands and thousands and thousands of Thanksgiving dinners from the proceeds that he made from that one book. So I think there's a lot to like about Tony Robbins, but the whole way that his events and just his whole platform is put together, I don't like that kind of stuff. Same thing for Gary Vaynerchuk, same thing for Grant Cardone, even though I really liked that book and the message behind it. You know, I'm able to disconnect the message from the messenger with a lot of this stuff. But I totally get it if other people have trouble doing that.
What about the 4-hour work week? Tim Ferriss?
There's a whole hour and a half rant on, I mean, episode on what I think about the 4-hour work week.
Okay. I just wondered if you'd be able to separate those two. That's all.
Well, that's a little bit different because I think the message there is, hey, this is easy, and it's not easy. You can do it. I think that's different than saying, hey, you only have to work 4 hours a week, which isn't the message of that book if you dig into it, but the provocative title makes it seem like it is. And I guarantee Tim Ferriss did that on purpose.
Oh, he totally did. Sorry, didn't mean to send you down that trail. All right, let's jump into the meat of the book. And I haven't put in every single chapter to work through. I didn't even put the chapter titles in the outline for today because I feel like there's some very specific points that we should work through for this particular book. And the first of those is the beginning of the book goes through some of the overarching problems with the world of positive thinking. And he tells this from the story of going to this Get Motivated conference and how people were all about thinking positively and trying to neglect or put aside the negative thinking that you're prone to. Like, don't do that, but think about how great you are and think about how awesome the future is going to be. Like, that was the overarching theme of the conference. Never been to one of these. I actually had never heard of this Get Motivated conference, even though he claims it's like the biggest one. Maybe that's, I don't know, something to do with time warp with when it was written versus now. But
he totally should have gone to a Tony Robbins event and done the firewalk and talked about that.
I kind of thought that because he does reference that later on. But the premise here is that, and this is the foundation that the rest of the book sits on. The premise is that the people who get into deep into positive thinking have a tendency to neglect or search for the negative thoughts in order to set them aside. And his whole premise here throughout the rest of it, and tell me if you agree with this, Mike, is that by trying to hunt down the negatives and set them aside, you actually make yourself worse off in the end, as opposed to better, which was your intention by doing the positive thinking and neglecting the negative thinking. Do you think it's a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, and I agree with that. I mean, he talks about the problem of positive thinking being that you have to scan for those negative thoughts, but scanning will draw attention to the negative thoughts. And so trying to get rid of everything negative is going to produce anxiety, insecurity, and sadness as you see all those things that are really there. So the effort that you spend trying to be happy can make you miserable. I agree with that 100%, but I also think that that doesn't mean you should completely stop trying to be happy or to discount everything that has a positive message to it. And that's my real issue with the way that the Get Motivated event is framed. Again, I understand all the issues with those types of things. I have never been to a Tony Robbins event, but I studied them and I asked and interviewed people who have been to them, what's it like? And from what I understand, it's like a big positive pep rally. And it goes against like every fiber of my being, the way that they describe these events where he's up on stage and he's making everybody jump up and down and they have like these dance contests with people. And I'm like, no, I don't want anything to do with that. But that doesn't mean that that doesn't work for some people. And then the other thing that really kind of raised a red flag in my head right away was this 18-month rule that he talks about. He says, the most likely person to buy a self-help book is someone who bought one in the last 18 months. And when I read that part, I'm like, yep, guilty. That's totally me. And then he adds this little dig, one that evidently didn't solve all their problems. And I was like, you don't get it. Like, I'm not buying these books because Good to Great or any of the books that we've read, even the ones that I've given 5 stars, I did not get that book to solve all my problems. I maybe got that book to solve a problem. And I think that's the difference that's worth calling out here at the very beginning, is that trying too hard to be happy, trying to achieve perfection, especially believing that one event or one book is going to provide all of the answers, that is going to be something that is just going to be frustrating. But if you can look at your life and you can say, here's one thing that would make me happier, and I want to make this change because I want to be happier, that is totally fine. And that is very much in line with the growth mindset that he calls out later, but very much against the broad description of the positive thinking culture that he highlights in this first chapter.
I think there's one, and obviously you and I are going to argue with him because we have a tendency to support this positive thinking world. But I think there's one fundamental issue I have with his structure and his foundation, and that is he makes the assumption that people who focus on positive thinking are in actuality focusing on the negative thoughts and trying to root them from their brain. And I think that is fundamentally flawed because that is something that I do not do. And I don't see it that way at all. Yes, I try to think positively and look at the bright side of things, but I'm not naive. Like I'm not saying the negative stuff isn't there. You know, obviously with the health stuff I've dealt with, it's certainly not something I can just say, hey, I feel great. Like, no, it doesn't work. I can't just say, yes, I'm better, and then all of a sudden be better. You know, that works for some people, but in most cases, it doesn't work that way.
And if you had taken that approach, you'd be miserable instead of on the verge of beating this thing.
Definitely. So I don't buy his foundation, which is unfortunate because the rest of this book, he has a lot of good points. And I do have a couple points here that I will act on as a result of reading this. I'm grateful for having read this, but I think his foundation is flawed, which of course is going to make me a skeptic for the rest of the book. So
exactly.
And I caught that within the first 10 pages and like, oh boy, here we go. So
this might have been better if the first chapter had been omitted and he just jumped into Stoicism.
Yeah, it might have. Yeah.
The last thing I'll say about this first chapter, the note that I jotted down, is that you shouldn't assume that any Booker system is going to solve all of your problems. And this is where I think the Stoic perspective is maybe a little bit different, and we would have to interview Ryan Holiday to really know this for sure, because he wrote the book The Obstacle is the Way. But I view this, and I'm glad you brought up your health battles, because from an outside perspective, you can tell me if this is wrong, it appears to me that you have just identified that this is the next hurdle I have to get over, so we're going to take care of this thing. And then there's another hurdle, and we're going to take care of that thing. And then there's probably another hurdle that you didn't know about or didn't see coming. And then you take care of that thing and you just keep going. You don't assume that this one pill that I'm going to take is going to magically fix all of these things. That would have caused you to be frustrated. And if you kept looking for those things, it might actually hurt you. Is that fair?
Absolutely. 100%. And there are a lot of things, obviously, when you have health issues, you can't help but reflect on them when you read something like this. And I continued to see how the way I've approached my healing process, which, by the way, I'm very close to the end of, if I'm not like within sight of it right now anyway. I haven't said that publicly. There you go. So, you know, having that history, you know, as we go through these things, I guess I can use that as a recurring example because it hasn't been simple. This has been an almost 2-year long process, which I know there are people that do much longer healing processes than I've been through. And some that are way worse. I'm not downplaying that. But at the same time, like, it hasn't been simple. And every time it seems like you'd get to one point, the next could be worse. It could be better. It could seem worse. Like, you never know. You don't know what's coming up. But if I had gone through what he's calling this positive thinking, don't think bad thoughts, like, no. I was thinking quite a few times, like, what happens if this kills me? Like, I had those thoughts on a regular basis. So it's not something that you're going to just magically make go away because you're thinking a certain direction. So I wouldn't say that I'm at the level of Ryan Holiday and the Stoics. But we can jump into that because it's a chapter that he goes into immediately after explaining this whole cult of positive thinking. I don't remember if he used the actual term cult. Do you remember if he did that or not?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I couldn't remember if I was...
The cult of optimism, I think, is how he defined it.
Okay. Maybe that's where I got that. I felt like I was imposing something on him, but it felt familiar. I don't know. But he talks about Stoicism, and if you don't know what Stoicism is, I'm probably the wrong person to explain it to you, but the general gist, the way I understand it, is that when things happen to you, you don't take a positive or negative stance on it. It is just a thing that has happened. It's not inherently good or bad, and it is your response to that thing that dictates your overarching reaction to it. So yes, if you're in a car accident, we would naturally say, oh, that's bad. Is it? Like that would be the question. It's like, well, you had a car accident. If someone got hurt, is that inherently bad? And some people would say yes. Some people will say no. It kind of depends on how you react to it. Sometimes when people have had an accident, it becomes the best thing that ever happened to them, which is always counterintuitive when you hear those stories. But it's your reaction to things that dictates whether it becomes a good or a bad thing. That's at least my view of Stoicism. Now, Mike, you can contradict me now if you'd like.
That is generally correct. Stoicism has been something that has fascinated me for a while. I don't consider myself a Stoic, but this in this section, he talks about that beliefs cause your distress, and that's a shared thought between Stoicism and positive thinking. And I agree with that. And I think that everything I shared at the beginning about the intentional family and like what we're trying to do to redeem this time that we find ourselves in, this could be classified as Stoic thinking, because you have this event where you have to stay home, school is canceled, all the extracurriculars are canceled, and that is not great. But that doesn't mean that good can't come out of it. And that's what we did. We viewed it, okay, this is what it is. So how do we redeem this time? How do we make the best of this time? How do we still do positive things during this time? And that's where I think I start to break away from the Stoic philosophy.
Sure.
Because he talks a lot in here about negative visualization, which I want to talk about, but I want to go back to like the perspective of how do you view like the current situation that we find ourselves in? Because this is something that I have been thinking a lot about. It is not a secret that I am a Christian and that my religious beliefs shape how I view the world. I think that when it comes to positive thinking and Stoicism and the role of faith with this, you can accept a situation for the way that it is, and you can wish and believe that it was different and will be different, and that those aren't necessarily at odds with each other. So as I find myself wanting this thing to change and to be done and to go back to life as normal, you know, and there's a process of walking that out. And even for somebody who considers themselves a man or a woman of faith, and you pray and you believe that God hears your prayers and things are going to change, there is a process. You don't see it all the time right away. And that doesn't mean that you stop. You keep doing the things that you know to do, and then you kind of release the results. And that, I think, is very much in alignment with a lot of the stuff that's in this book, is that you recognize what is going on. You're not making a value judgment about it. You're doing what you know you need to do, regardless of whether you fall into positive, negative, whatever. I almost feel like the subtitle of this book is kind of a distraction for the real value of the information that's in here, almost, because it forces you to pick a side. And I think that there's a lot of value in recognizing that you don't have control over everything that's going on, and that's okay. Just do what you know to do. And then like the way I would say it based on my belief system would be, do your best and let God do the rest. Okay. But even if you don't believe in God, there has to be an element of that. That's kind of what he's preaching. And I use the word preaching intentionally through the rest of this book, is that you're not going to be able to control everything. So if you try to control everything, you're just going to get frustrated. You're going to get anxious. That's kind of the point of the whole first chapter. So stoicism here, where he's talking about disconnect your feelings from the actual event. Just recognize the event for what it is. I think that's a really interesting idea.
And it's a hard one to follow through on, I think.
Definitely.
Your gut reaction is you get in a car accident. Oh my goodness, this is just terrible. Like this is a terrible thing that happened. When I learned that I had Lyme disease, like it was devastating when it first happened. But at this particular point in time, like I'm one of those weird people that would tell you that I'm grateful for having had Lyme disease at this point, because it's taught me so much about good health, and I've learned how horribly I was living and helped me to develop a much better lifestyle. So at this point, I'm grateful to have somehow contracted Lyme disease. I think it was through mosquitoes, but it's a whole nother scientific conversation to have, not on Bookworm. But I feel like when it first came, like when that first happened, when I first learned that I had Lyme disease, it was one that was very difficult to come to grips with, and borderline sent me into a bit of a depression until figuring out what to do about it, talking to a couple doctors who specialize in alternative medicine and being willing to ask the questions around what's the right path forward for this, and being willing to fight instead of just giving up and saying, whoops, well, I guess my life's over. Because some people do that. Some people who receive that diagnosis borderline shut down entirely.
Yep.
And don't even try. Like that is the opposite of what you're after. Like you need to take, you know, I'm not one that studies stoicism. I don't know that I would call myself a stoic. I don't even know if I really want to call myself a stoic or go down that path. But seeing the benefits of like just evaluating things as they are and then reacting to them, I don't think I would go that far. I think to your point, like with the book, it's not sides. There is a medium. I forget what the name of that argument is. There's an argument that, you know, there's a title for it. Like whenever someone makes it a choice between one thing and another, but there's actually a middle ground and they don't acknowledge that. There's a name for that, but I can't think of what it is. Stoicism, I feel, is the same way as like what you're saying with this book. I don't feel that it has to be you're either all in with stoicism or you're not. Like I feel like there is a middle ground of being willing to acknowledge things and choosing your reaction to them. But I'm okay inherently saying something's good or bad to a certain degree. Like that's my tendency.
Exactly.
Like I'm okay with that.
You have to be willing to say things are good or bad, because there was something that you said, and I forget exactly the way that you said it. When something lands in front of you, you have the choice whether to accept or reject that. And he talks about how later on specifically, we tend to reject any sort of thought on the topic of death. And I want to separate that for a moment and just think about the concept of there's something that's presented to you and you have the ability to accept or reject that as truth. And everybody is going to make that decision based on their own model, what they consider to be true. But I think there is a lot of truth to the fact that you don't have to assume control of everything that every person or everything is going to try to put on you. You don't necessarily have to sign for the package. I have had people tell me over and over again that you are going to have what's the celiac disease, where you're not going to be able to eat bread. I love bread. And so every time that they try to tell me that, or they try to get me tested, whatever, and they're trying to prove their theory, I'm like, nope. I feel fine. I eat bread all the time. I don't want to project sickness onto myself, because I know that when I start doing that, I will start to feel sick.
Yep.
And I know that there are people who do struggle with that, and making that change really does improve the quality of their life. So I'm not talking about ignoring what is there. And I think that's the distinction I'm trying to make here, is there is a difference between pretending something isn't happening and saying, yep, okay, this is what it is. Now what's the best path forward from here? And choosing the correct way to respond in those different situations, by the way, is a little bit tricky. If somebody were to come in to tell me, hey, you've got celiac disease, when I don't feel bad after I eat bread, that's very different than when somebody is telling you, hey, you've contracted Lyme disease and here are some things that you can do to mitigate and beat this thing. You're not going to bury your head in the sand and just say, nope, I don't have it. I refuse to accept Lyme disease, because the whole time you are miserable, you have no energy, you have the aches and pains. Like, there are times when you do have to, though, just block that stuff out of your mind, I think. And it's tricky to know the difference there. That is the thing that I struggle with where we are right now, is where is that line? And I'm constantly asking myself, how am I responding, and am I responding appropriately? Because I don't want to walk in fear. I believe that spirit of fear, you can see that anytime you go to the store and just look at people's faces, they're terrified of catching this thing. And I feel like that negative energy, that does attract some of this stuff. And I don't want to pass that along to my kids. So I'm going to be careful that I'm not living that way, but I'm also going to be wise and I'm not going to the store unless I have to.
Right. I told our girls, because they were getting a little nervous because they'd seen other people like take multiple steps back whenever they get close to us when we're walking on the street, and they're like trying to make sure that they're not getting too close by accident. They're like, is it really that dangerous, Dad? I was like, well, the absolute worst that could happen is you could die and then we go to heaven. So I'm not too concerned about it. Like
this is, yeah. And that's where negative visualization comes in with this chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a thing that frustrates other people whenever you say that, like, well, I'm not too concerned about it. At the same time, like we were talking beforehand, it's my job to run a lot of the live streams, all of the live streams that our church does. So anything video related ends up going through me. I've become way more popular than I ever wanted to be. And as a result of that, I end up being in these scenarios where there's a lot of people in that building sometimes. You know, they're all being careful about not getting too close to each other and trying to make sure there's not too many people in one room at a time. Like, they're careful about that, but you're still in the same building. And it's like, well, we're just going to sacrifice Joe for the sake of everybody else. It's okay. It's all right. I'll be fine. No, maybe that's just me being naive. But at the same time, I know if I do that, it allows, you know, at this point, close to 1,000 or more than 1,000 people to stay home and not go out. So it's a big deal for me to do that. So that's why I'm okay with it. But all right, stoicism, I like the concept. I think there's middle ground. I would like to go into it.
Yes. One other quick point on the negative visualization. This is something that I had heard about a while back, and I don't like the way that he described it here, but if you want a good explanation of this, check out the Tim Ferriss Fear Setting TED Talk, where it's basically goal setting, but you're envisioning a worst case scenario. And again, this is the type of thing that doesn't really fit with the way that I think, but I see the value in it, because the basic idea there is that if you picture the worst case event, it's not going to be as bad as that. Just like if you picture the best case event, it's probably not going to be as good as that, which can cause you to be disappointed. So the opposite end of that, the negative visualization, is picture the worst thing that could happen, and then everything that would happen above that, it's just gravy.
Sure.
So confronting that worst case scenario saps it of its anxiety-inducing power, he says, which is really true. And you kind of did that, you know, when you're talking to your kids and you say, well, if we die, worst thing that happens is we go to heaven, you know? And you can apply that. It doesn't have to be death. That doesn't always have to be the worst case scenario. Although that is a topic in this book. So I think it's not off topic to think of it that way.
Yeah. As far as like the negative visualization piece goes, that is where I started. I have one action item from this, and it all involves journal prompts. I've been doing more journaling at night. I think our next book will encourage that to some degree, but I've been doing more of that, and I've been slowly changing up some of the prompts that I use as part of that. And this is where one of them came from. It's like, okay, in the scenarios that I'm dealing with today, what's the worst that could happen? Like, take the live streaming, for example. A lot of things can go wrong when it comes to live streaming. Like people think, oh yeah, just turn it on. No, it is not that simple. it is quite complex if you're going to do a really well produced live stream. And the worst that could happen is it goes down. You know,
yep.
We get kind of bent out of shape and we're very particular with it. And I do a lot of backups and such. But the absolute worst that could happen is it goes down. We apologize. We try again. So it's okay.
Yeah. And with the technical stuff specifically, I'm glad you brought that up because that's like the place that everyone could probably agree to take a stoic approach. Because when the stream goes down, it's not morally good or bad. It just is. And everybody knows that there is a technical cause that thing is down.
Yep. Yep.
So you can just say, okay, the stream is down. What can I do about this? What's the best thing to do right now? As opposed to if you do attribute a moral judgment to that, then you're freaking out because, oh my gosh, the stream is down. This is terrible. All these people can't see it. Well, I can't even think of a positive scenario where you think it's good that the stream went down, but you get my point, you know, that like, right. If you're able to detach the meaning, you can solve the problem a lot quicker.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I've jokingly said that working in IT has helped me beat Lyme disease and a mold infection because it has shown me how things just go bad for no reason sometimes.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's not a good thing. You know, it went down. Okay. What can we do about it? These four things. Okay. Let's start at number one. Let's start working our way through them. That's kind of just become my approach to life. Maybe I'm stoic. I don't know. I don't think of it that way.
Well, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of alignment actually between Stoicism and Christianity. There's a verse that says the rain falls on the just and the unjust, you know, and I think that I call that out specifically because I think a lot of people think of Christians as just burying their heads in the sand and just confessing the positive things. The Bible says like this stuff is going to happen. So what are you going to do when it happens? You're not going to get upset. Oh, this is terrible. The rain should not be falling on me right now. It's literally told you it's going to.
And here we are. All right. Buddhism. You ready for Buddhism? I'm not someone who understands Buddhism very well. Like I have a decent grasp on Stoicism. Buddhism, I just don't. I feel like I should, even though we just read, you know, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I feel like there's some overlap there, but there's a couple things in this section. He talks about Buddhism, and the primary piece of it that I got from him is this concept of non-attachment. And it's that in Buddhism, if I understand this correctly, there's an acknowledgement that we have a tendency to attach to expectations, and that becomes what lets us down because those expectations are not met. So an example of this would be, all right, we'll continue the Lyme disease health thing. If I hold the expectation that I should not have received this diagnosis of Lyme disease, like if I hold that expectation that that's not something that should have happened, I will become upset and my ego will be hurt as a result of that. And it'll become a detrimental thing to me. So if I hold that expectation, I become attached to this concept of, I guess, security and stability. Like if that's the thing that I'm attached to, when bad things or things that threaten that happen, it's a major problem. And he, as a result of understanding that, went and did a meditation retreat. Have you ever done one of these, Mike? I feel like this is something we've seen come up from time to time. They like people in our books tend to do these from, you know, on occasion. I always like whenever I read them, I'm like, huh, I wonder if I should do that sometime. And then I read the end of it and think, I really don't want to do that.
Nope.
So
I have not, and I will not. Sorry.
But as a result of this meditation retreat, he became aware of, one, the noise that goes on around us and this lack of calm that is around us. And all of that is due to this attachment on our expectation. Like we're expecting certain things and we're attached to that. Do you feel like I covered this okay? I feel like I really struggled to understand this. I'm like trying to process what I read right now.
Yeah, the thing is, I wish that he had not called this The Buddhist Guide to Not Thinking Positively, because it's really talking about mindfulness meditation, which is not a spiritual practice. I feel like you can tie it to Buddhism, but you can also tie it to any other religion. Maybe not any other religion, but I think there's elements of this where mindfulness meditation is simply recognizing what your mind is focusing on and then letting it go. You're not attaching to it. You're not, and that's the mistake that a lot of people make when they start trying to meditate, is they get frustrated with themselves. Oh, I shouldn't be thinking about what I need to do after this session. You just recognize that, oh, I was thinking about something else instead of my breath, and you recenter, you refocus, you train your brain. I think that's essentially what he's saying here, but obviously he's tying it to Buddhism and the Buddha's story and stuff like that. One thing I want to go back just a little bit here, because you were talking about the diagnosis of the Lyme disease, and I want to call out, because I think this is really important, and I'll stop talking about this after this. But when someone okay. comes to give you a diagnosis, you have the opportunity to accept or reject that. And there are people who accept a diagnosis without actually anything being wrong in their body. And they think they've got cancer, so they die of cancer, but then they go to they do the biopsy afterwards and they find out there's no cancer. And they've just convinced themselves mentally that they have cancer, so they end up dying. There are medical cases of that. And so I think that's an important distinction to make out. Don't just assume that because somebody said something that you sign for that package and you take that on. Now, if you do have something that you are dealing with, then these are the facts that I am faced with. This is the situation I find myself in. Then you figure out what you do from that point forward. And for me, faith is always a piece of that. But I want to call that out, because nothing and no one is infallible. And just because somebody said something once, regardless of it's a doctor or a self-help guru or your shrink or whatever, like, don't just blanket accept everything that people say about you. Now, back to the Buddhism thing. I don't know much about Buddhism. I am not fascinated in the least about the Buddha's story. And this chapter was really tough for me to get through. But I do think that the whole idea of mindfulness meditation is really powerful. And that's really what he's talking about here in terms of the benefits from this, where mindfulness meditation, he says meditation and he ties it to Buddhism, but I've seen the research reports. It's mindfulness meditation that reduces pain and teaches you that it's temporary. It's not a Buddhist teaching. It's a mindfulness meditation practice that causes that. And I agree with the anti-procrastination advice, which is typically to get you to feel better about acting, and how feeling like acting and acting are two very different things. Big point being that you don't need to wait until you feel like it in order to actually do something. Professionals just do the work. Completely agree with all of that. Just wish it wasn't attached to an Eastern religion. I feel like that's going to alienate a bunch of people.
Sure. One thing I want to point out about that is that there is a thing where people who have Lyme disease, it's pretty common, if you're able to get past Lyme disease, to pick up a mold infection, which is exactly what I did. And I didn't realize we were going to have like a health podcast here. With that, generally what happens is one of two things. When you come out of Lyme disease, you have a tendency to become aware of the things you should avoid, like from foods and, you know, smells, scents, that sort of thing. Like you learn what you should and shouldn't be around, and things that can cause issues or flare-ups during the process of healing. When you come into the mold infection world, it's very easy, and the most common thing that people do is immediately search their house for mold, assume that they have a mold infection in the house, try to clean it, move. They do all kinds of things and try in an attempt to remediate that and prevent the mold from existing in their house. When most people have learned how to deal with it and synthesize that and deal with the, like, your body can deal with that mold. If you have a mold infection, your brain tells you need to avoid it, when that's actually probably the last thing you should be doing. Because it's like the whole peanut allergy concept. The more you keep people away from it, the more likely they are to get the allergy. When like they're learning now, if you slowly introduce it back, like they can take people who are deathly allergic to peanuts and help them become tolerable of them. They may not be able to eat them constantly like everyone else, but it at least won't kill them. You know, that's, it's the same thing. I bring this up because this is a thing that can become so bad that a lot, I shouldn't say a lot, some people develop what's called multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome, MCS. And a primary way I've seen people fight that is with something called DNRS, Dynamic Neural Retraining System. I'll explain that here in a second. But it's something that I kind of have used to beat the mold process. All of this is brought up because it all comes down to the way you think about things when you are exposed to them, which is a lot of what we're talking about with Stoicism and Buddhism here.
Yeah.
With DNRS, what you're doing is when you are exposed to things like, say, new paint, like you teach yourself to think about it as, it's fine. It's not something that's going to hurt me. As opposed to when you smell that, immediately trying to get out of there because you're afraid it's going to cause a reaction. Each of those responses is valid. One will help you learn to deal and process those things. The other, the latter of those two, will end up causing you to get worse over time. So much so that some people actually have to become homeless and live on boats because they can't be around anything in the air in modern society. You don't want to go down that road. All of that comes down to the way you think about things and the way you react to the surroundings that you're in. I have, of course, studied this significantly because I feel like this is part of my healing process, but it could have very easily gone the other way. Am I saying that Buddhism is exactly the answer you should go through? Absolutely not. I don't even think of mindfulness meditation as the answer to that. I think that's just one piece of the toolkit, but I'll stop rambling now. I feel like all of this can be extremely beneficial if you come at it from the right view.
Yes, absolutely. But you do have to come at it from the right view, and you do have to tease out the good stuff and spit out the sticks, which is really true about every single book that we read.
Yep. It's typical. Okay, can we say no to goals? I want to say no to goals. Let's move on.
Yes, just say no.
Yeah, there's a whole section in here about how goals are a bad thing. And I have to say, I was excited about this part. I feel like you were probably excited about this part.
Indeed. this section starts with a story about the people who are trying to climb Mount Everest, and there's a bunch of them that are climbing it at the same time, and they're all so obsessed with their goal that they all know that they have to reach a certain point by a certain time, otherwise they have to turn around or they're going to die. And they get so obsessed with reaching the summit that they climb, and they don't get there by the time, but oh, but it's so close. They just keep going, and they're watching this from afar, and every single person is like, what are they doing? And sure enough, they all die because they're up there too late, and they lose their way at night, and they get stuck in a blizzard, and then they die. This, I feel like, is a little bit sensational when it comes to setting goals, because what it's saying is that when you see the summit, you're tempted to break the rules. Agree with that. And on a good day, you get away with it, but on a bad day, you die. I think on most of them, on a bad day, you're not going to die. But I understand the message here, that you get so engrossed with accomplishing the goal that you don't recognize the harm that it's doing.
Yes. I don't like goals. I've learned that whenever I set goals, it becomes the thing I don't achieve. And, you know, again, I set a goal at one point to see if I could beat Lyme disease by a certain point. I did that, and then I blew past it, and that's now been about a year ago. So here we are. I just don't, you know, we've railed on goals how many times, but I don't think that his thing is, like, whenever you have the goal, like, you have a tendency to fixate on it, and you'll set things aside and that don't pertain to it, and in the end, you end up making it harder to achieve the goal, and it gets worse. I don't like goals. I like that he railed on him.
So here's the thing, though. You mentioned you set the goal to beat Lyme. And the advice when people set goals is to set SMART goals. Specific, measurable, all that junk. You know, and then you have a specific date tied with it. And I feel like it's the date being associated with it that causes a lot of the negative ramifications with goals. I think having the goal and having it be very detailed and knowing exactly what you're supposed to do to move in the right direction, that's not a bad thing. But if you set it and forget it, and you have this date associated with it, and the date comes and goes, then yeah, you will find yourself frustrated that it didn't happen. But what if you constantly adjusted the goal? What if every single week you looked at the goal and you updated it with new information as you figured out that actually this direction that I was going when I set this thing isn't the right thing to do anymore, and now the next action is this, and instead of achieving it by next week, it's going to be next year. I think there would be a lot of value in taking that approach. The problem with that approach is that it is a ton of mental maintenance. And I'm thinking about that specifically because did the webinar yesterday with Sean on task management, time blocking, things like that. And people were asking about scheduling your tasks. And I agree with that. But my advice and Sean's advice too was don't even decide when you're going to do a task until you decide these are the three things I'm going to do today. And then you put them on your calendar. And people would say, well, what about all the other stuff in my task manager? Should I put dates on all that? Absolutely not, because by the end of the next day, it's all going to be wrong. And I feel like that's the real issue with the goal. The goal itself in the moment can probably produce a lot of good and motivation, but then it's quickly out of date. What do you think about that?
Yes, because I have tried to do things similar to this and have even like laid out, here are the things I'm going to do for the next 2 days. Guess what? It doesn't work.
doesn't happen. Right.
And it's because like by noon, today is different. And of course, that's going to change tomorrow. So it just doesn't work at all. It just doesn't. So I am with you 100%. I mean, I'm cool with setting dates on specific things like taking out the trash, like something along those lines. I'm cool with, you know, maybe you have a task that can only be done on a certain day. Like I'm cool with that. But when it comes to trying to lay out like a week ahead of time and here are the things I'm going to work on this week, even if I'm left to my own devices and working on my own things, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because I'm one of these idea people and I just come up with things all the time and it's like, oh, let's go try that. And, you know, oh, well, no, that's a bad idea. I shouldn't be doing that one anymore. So that changes the whole week. It just doesn't work. It doesn't. Maybe that's just me. It doesn't sound like it's just me. I don't like doing it. Can I stop doing it? I'm going to stop doing it.
Yeah. Well, see, I think the reason that people set goals, he says, is that they're attracted to goals because they dislike uncertainty. And I totally understand that. I dislike uncertainty too. I wish I knew exactly when life was going to return to normal, but I don't, and it drives me nuts. So as I've been thinking about the topic of time blocking a lot lately, I'm realizing that I can apply certainty to a certain degree to my day. Again, that plan is going to be blown up. I know that. So it's not worth trying to plan more than 1 day in advance. But planning 1 day in advance, that does give me enough certainty and intentionality that even my overactive brain can focus on what it should be doing and get to work. When I don't time block, that's when I get distracted and I get nervous. And so in one sense, time blocking is setting a goal for how you're going to go through your day. It's just a very small chunk of time. And I feel like that works for me. But when you project way out, that's when things are going to go off the rails and they're probably going to go off the rails spectacularly. There's a story in here about the person who was training for a marathon. They ran the marathon. They hurt themselves, had to stay at home for several weeks. I did that exact same thing.
Nice.
First time I ran my half marathon, I set the goal to run the half marathon. And I even, when I was doing the training, was kind of bragging about the fact that like I hated running and this was the ultimate test of mind over matter for me. If I can do this, I can do anything. I overtrained. My patella tendon slipped off of my kneecap the week before the race. I ran the race anyways, finished it. And I remember crossing the finish line. I knew that I had hurt my knee. I didn't think it was something super major, like I'd torn anything, but I was in pain. And I remember crossing the finish line, getting the medal, taking the picture, and thinking to myself, now what? I accomplished my goal. Now what do I do? And it's like, oh, I hurt my knee. This is going to affect me for the next several weeks. It did. I took like 6 weeks off and then didn't get any better. So I had to do physical therapy. That lasted, I think, another 6 weeks. Then I started running again, and I upped my distance too fast, had to deal with plantar fasciitis, and again had to take like 6 weeks off. And so I'd basically start from scratch when I started running again. And that was about the time that I started reading Atomic Habits. And the identity-based habits clicked with me, and I realized that I had set this goal to run this half marathon. That was the wrong approach. I needed to take the James Clear approach and instead identify myself as a runner. The moment that I did that, it was a lot more fun when I would go for my runs. It was not training in order to accomplish a goal. It was doing something that I enjoyed because it was part of who I was. And so that is the thing that I think goals are dangerous. But again, if you take away the date, if I don't have to run a half marathon by a certain time or a certain day, then maybe that changes how I approach that practice. I don't know. Maybe I never would have done it in the first place. I'm not sure. But I do think that you can do these things. You can have these goals. You just have to frame them the right way. And unfortunately, the way that many people are trained to set their goals, that kind of sets them up for failure.
Which is exactly what you should embrace.
Oh, nicely done. Nicely done.
Nailed it. Nailed it. Next topic is embrace failure. So, and again, this is another thing we've talked about in the past. Like, don't be afraid to make mistakes. And he starts this whole chapter off with a story about a museum. I'm drawing a blank on the name of it now. GFK, something like that. I forget what it stands for. But it's a museum of failed products, which sounded fascinating to me. And I really wanted to go through it.
Yep.
Which is why corporate executives pay money to go through it, because they want to see what doesn't work and why. So I was intrigued by that. But at the same time, like, I have a long list of my own failures. I shouldn't say I have a list. I know I have a lot of failures. I haven't actually listed them, though. Maybe I should. I don't want to do that.
Start a museum.
I know, right? A museum. Joe's failures. And we've got Analog Joe, and now we have Failed Joe. So this is a thing that I don't want to do. I'm not planning to do, but it would be interesting to see, like, of the things I've tried to do in the past, the things I've failed at, and just examine them. What worked, what didn't work. Like, I have a tendency, like, oh, that didn't work, you know, cast it aside and move on, and then not spend much time with it. That's the opposite of what he's proposing here.
Yep.
If you have a failure, embrace it, become aware of it, learn from it, and move on. There you go.
Yeah, so this is where he talks about Carol Dweck and her research. And the point that he's making in this chapter, the subtitle of this chapter, is the case for embracing your errors. And it very easily, I think, can get to the point where you are relishing those failures. And I don't think that's healthy. So he mentions Carol Dweck, the fixed theory versus the incremental theory, or fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And having read Mindset, I would argue that Carol Dweck's approach would not be try to fail and then celebrate that you failed, but when you fail, ask yourself why and recognize that you're able to try something else and figure out a way that works. If all you're doing is searching for how can I fail next, I don't necessarily think that that leads to eventual success. I think there's a difference there. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not guaranteed. I think you have to be willing to at least try. I think that would be the point.
Yeah, you have to be willing to try. You have to give it your best shot, and you have to believe that what you're trying could possibly succeed. What if you were actually successful? I think that's a key part to mindset. But I don't think that comes across in the two pages that he devotes to this. And I feel like it's kind of tacked on as growth mindset is embracing your errors. Not necessarily. It's recognizing that the error occurred and figuring out what you can learn from this, but it's not building a monument to that error and staying there forever. I think that's an important difference that's worth calling out here, because I kind of get the, and maybe this is just sensationalized because this is what he's trying to do by attacking the cult of optimism, is to just rail against all this stuff that other people are, like the traditional way that people are doing this, and to provide like a very contradictory approach to this. Like maybe he's trying to be provocative with this stuff and he takes it further than he would in conversation over coffee or something like that. But I think that you gotta recognize that you made a mistake, yes, but absolutely not do you build a any sort of monument to those failures. You recognize that this thing happened and this is the path to go from here. Like this is the path forward, but then you leave. You don't stay there. And I think there is a temptation for a lot of people to stay there because they want to be able to look back at that and say, check out this badge of honor. Check out all these things that I failed. You know, the common quote, Einstein or Edison had 10,000 steps to the light bulb, 9,999 things that didn't work. But do you think he had a catalog of all of those items that he was like taking around to parties and being like, hey, everybody, check this out. Check out all these failures. Like, absolutely not. And I feel like, especially with the internet connected age that we live in, that can be the other extreme of this. I don't think that's healthy. And maybe I'm making too big a deal out of this, but his whole point here is that you don't need to fear this failure. You need to embrace this. It's going to be everywhere. 90% of products fail, and you need to be willing to persevere in the midst of those setbacks. And you need to be possessed enough charisma to convince other people to follow you. You know, that's, he talks about those are the characteristics of successful entrepreneurs. They're also the characteristics of unsuccessful entrepreneurs, but that doesn't mean that they're bad. And that's where like the survivor bias, he uses this as a thing to say like the goals are bad. This I thought was interesting on the heels of the goals chapter. I thought of this right away because I've been thinking about this. I think I even shared it on Bookworm, how people interview sports teams that win the title. And there's this bias towards goals because they say, yeah, man, at the beginning of the year, we set a goal to win the Super Bowl and we worked hard every single day and we won. Well, what about the other 29 teams or in college, hundreds of other teams that had the exact same goal that didn't achieve it? You know, that doesn't mean that setting the goal was the thing that got them there, but it also doesn't mean that setting the goal was a bad thing. There's a difference between correlation and causation there.
Yes. 100% with you. Good job, Mike. Anything else you want to say about failure? I can't say I've got anything else to say. I want to talk about death.
All right, talk about the ultimate failure.
One of the last main chapters is discussing death and how we have a tendency to talk about it quite a bit, but then we don't really think about it and we try to ignore it. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have a bunch of articles and people talk about things to do before you die, or, you know, this is my bucket list. That's a bucket item. Like, we talk about that sort of thing. But do you actually stop long enough to think through death and the end of your life? And it's something we just don't like to think about. Now, I would imagine that given that Mike and I are Christians, we probably think about it more than normal.
Yep.
You know, given society and our culture, I would imagine it's on your mind and my mind more than most people. And I think that's fine. I know as someone who runs sound for funerals on a regular basis, at least not lately, you know, that's maybe a bit of a positive with coronavirus, but whenever I'm running sound for funerals, I'm around that a lot. And it's something that I'm kind of forced to grapple with. You know, it's not a simple task to run the event of a funeral for a mom who passed away, who has four kids that are under 10 years old. That's not easy. It's not easy to run sound or help with the tech side of the funeral of a 7-year-old girl who has loving parents and a family who now miss her, and she was the baby of the family. Like, that's hard. That's not simple. And it's something that will cause you to go home and cry for hours sometimes. So I feel like I've been forced to embrace and think about death quite a bit. I get that, you know, with him and his in this book, like he just wants it to be something that is on your mind. At least that was my perspective on it. He just wants you to be willing to think through death, not as something that should be avoided or not discussed, but as something to come to grips with, because it's the one thing that unifies all of us that we can't all escape. Like, we will all die at some point. So that's something that you have to come to grips with and be okay thinking about and discussing. Thus, I'm discussing it. See, I've done my part, Mike. I'm done. I can go home now.
And this is the thing that when I read this chapter, instantly thought of the news that is surrounding the coronavirus, and the statistic that every news source everywhere is tracking is how many people have gotten it and how many people have died. And that is causing a lot of people to be very negative and to be very fearful. And when he's talking about mortality salience, now people typically will actively work to avoid thinking about death. I totally get it. And for a lot of people, they're being forced to do that now and they don't like it. for you and I specifically, yeah, you're right. This is something that we probably think about more often. And I think that right now that is having positive effects. So death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? Right? Because we die. Oh, well, we go on to the next thing.
Right.
And that's not saying we're right, you're wrong, whatever, but it's just a thought process that that's the way we're wired internally, and it does help keep you more stable. That was one observation I had just regarding this chapter and then where we find ourselves. There is a little bit of, in this chapter, he does talk about the Mexican Day of the Dead and like the parades and things that they would do for this. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Yes, I have been aware of this for a few years now, but yeah.
Okay. Well, I was at the Sean West conference in Austin, Texas on the Mexican Day of the Dead. Ooh. And there is a big Mexican population in Austin, Texas, and they had the parade and it went right past the conference venue while Sean was delivering the keynote.
Nice.
So I obviously you hear all this stuff, so you go peek outside and people are walking through the streets with like the skeletons on a string. It's just weird. Well, it was weird to me. I shouldn't say it's weird, because I'm sure like culturally, you know, we're just not used to that. I thought when it happened that this is bizarre. I don't know why anybody would really want to do this. I do think that that is personally kind of maybe taking it a little too far. I think death is worth embracing as a fact of life. Don't deny that it's going to happen. Now, on the other side of this, are you familiar with Dan Sullivan, strategic coach?
I know his name. I couldn't tell you much about him, though.
He's the guy who did the unique ability thing that I had sent you. And so I like a lot of Dan Sullivan's stuff. However, he has a book, which I will send you the link to.
Okay.
Actually, I'll put this in the club.
Put it in the live chat.
Yeah, so Dan Sullivan has this thing that he does. It's called the Lifetime Extender. It's basically a worksheet, and this is an ebook called My Plan for Living to 156. And the description says, you have a number we all do. Once your brain locks onto your imagined lifespan, your body accepts it as fact. I think this is ridiculous. So this is the other thing I thought of as I was going through this chapter, is like the exact opposite, where people are projecting that they're going to live forever or even further longer than anybody ever has. I know that this is kind of prevalent now. And like I said, I think this is kind of ridiculous, but I feel like this is the other end of the spectrum, and the healthy approach is somewhere in the middle, where you recognize that someday you will die, and so you're not scared of it. It's going to happen. You're not looking forward to it either, and you're not trying to make it happen. But if you were to take either one of those approaches, you're going to rob from the present. You're not going to be able to make the most of the time that you have. And I feel like regardless of your religious belief system, that's really your goal, your job, your objective is to, there's that word goal, but you get what I mean. Like your mission while you are here, regardless of how you choose to define it, is to make the most of the time that you've got. For some people, that may be, you know, touch as many lives as you can. For some people, that may mean accumulate as much as you can. I think you and I would probably have issues with some approaches over others, but that's ultimately what everybody's trying to do. And I think recognizing that there's a beginning and there's an end to your lifespan, that's inherent in a healthy approach to this.
You know, as a way to show like how this can come about in real life and like what this can lead to, I have added it to one of the journal prompts that I've added as an action item is what would happen if I died today? Like that's one of the journal prompts. Now that's not a question I really want to think about daily, but it's something that I have found. I've been trying to use that one the last probably 4 or 5 days. And it's interesting how that changes the way I interact with my kids specifically, because I'm a lot more grateful for the day that I have with them when I'm considering what would happen if I wasn't here tomorrow. Because I'm grateful to have that time to read Narnia to them and play Hide the Squishmallow. That's inside joke for Mike.
You know, it's still playing, a game.
It's totally still a game. I should like, we should do like an Instagram live for that because it's just intense.
All right.
That was a joke. I'm not actually doing that. I don't even know how I would do that. But my point is that considering my own mortality is a good thing because it shows me that I need to be grateful for what I have now. Now, I could, you know, could, and a lot of people recommend that you do this, have like a gratitude journal where you're writing about the things you're grateful for. But I've done that in the past, and I don't want to poo-poo that because I think there are a lot of people that find that as a great thing and it works great for them. That's awesome. I have found that contemplating the opposite helps me become more grateful in the last 4 or 5 days anyway, that considering the worst case scenario from my own stance has led me to become more invested in the people around me as much as I can anyway, given, you know, self-isolation. But you get my point. Like, this is something that I have found extremely valuable and yet difficult to recommend to other people because it just is morbid to recommend. But here we are.
It's one of those topics that's kind of socially taboo. And I think maybe it shouldn't be, but also I get why it is.
Absolutely. Yep. Anything else you want to cover on the book before we do action items?
One thing at the end, he talks about practicing memento mori, which literally means remember that you shall die. And his recommended exercise, I think, is pretty cool. Imagine you're 80 years old and then answer the questions I wish I had spent more time on and I wish I had spent less time on. There is a book dedicated to this specific thing, which is really good. I've mentioned it before, 30 Lessons for Living. I forget who wrote it, but it was somebody who had interviewed thousands of people in nursing homes. And if you go into a nursing home, usually it's a very negative atmosphere, but there's always a couple people there who are just different. They're happy, they're upbeat, they are making the most out of their time in this life. And so those are the types of people that he interviewed. And he condensed every one of their answers into these basically like 30 different points, the things that he heard over and over and over again. And I think that is a really cool idea. That book was really, really good. It was a really entertaining and really informative read. If you're interested in this topic, that would be the place that I would send people to look.
For sure. All right. I have one action item from this book, and I've mentioned it a few times already, and that's journal prompts. With trying to do more journaling lately, because theoretically we have more time now than we did before. False. I have been using a couple different prompts in that, you know, the one I just mentioned, what would happen if I was gone after today? And another is what would happen if those closest to me were gone tomorrow? Like, it's kind of a flip on it. And you tend to answer those a little bit differently, but you get the concept. Like, that's what I'm trying to just try to go through that on a daily basis to keep those not necessarily top of mind, but just aware of those on a regular basis, because I have found, at least in my short time doing those, that they are helpful in making me aware of the positives when I'm also aware of the negatives, which I think is likely the point of the whole book, Mike.
Could be. I don't think he actually says that. No. There's so much emphasis on the negative, but
it's true. It's
but
true.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I actually have an action item too. And let's see, it comes from chapter 6, where he talks about, we didn't really get into this, but the idea of the threats and how when people watch the news, it kind of normalizes things that you wouldn't normally think could happen to you. And then you start expecting that every time you get on the subway or get on a bus, that the person behind you has got a bomb in their shoes. Like, you see that stuff on the news and then you project it into your own situation. I think that is totally happening right now with this coronavirus stuff. So my action item is to stop watching the news. I shouldn't say stop watching the news, stop following the news. I'm not going to do it completely because I do want to know what is going on, but I have found myself over the last several days erring on the side of paying too much attention to the news and recognizing the emotional impact that it has on me. I never feel good when I'm done. So limiting that to maybe in the morning and then maybe in the evening, and everything else, you know, just completely avoid it. Because that's the thing, if I check it, you know, during lunch or whatever, that's the kind of thing that can sabotage the rest of my day and zap my energy and my motivation. And I want to avoid that.
That's fair. I follow the news so well that I didn't even know that the CARES Act was a thing until I think 2 weeks after it was initially posed. And someone said, hey, what are you going to do with your care check? I was like, what's a care check? I don't know what that is. And to explain it all to me. Oh, I didn't know this was a thing. When did this come about? Like 2 weeks ago, Joe. Like, oh, apparently I'm good at keeping up with things. Who knew?
Yeah, and that impacted your life negatively. How?
It didn't. Exactly. Like, oh, spoiler alert. Yeah, great. Awesome. Now, how do I get the right data rate on my live stream feed? That's what I'm focused on.
Yeah.
All right. So let's step into style and rating. I will say that for the most part, he's a pretty easy author to read. He's good with stories. A few times I was thinking the stories didn't have anything to do with what he was making a point of. And sometimes I felt like he was picking out stories that were there to complicate matters or explain things that he didn't seem to have a good point overall. That was especially in like the Buddhism section. I was like, I have no idea what you're getting at here. There's also a whole section on like arguing between the difference between I and me. I am so lost on what you're talking about. And that got difficult. I understood all of his stories. I loved the stories, but then it seemed like whenever he tried to tie them together, it got a little difficult to follow. I will say, overall, I'm glad to have read this. You know, I feel like this is, I don't want to say it's a breath of fresh air. It's not, but it's interesting to read something that's kind of the opposite of what we normally would read. It's like, you know,
it's a gust of contrary wind.
Set goals. And this, and he comes in like, no, don't do that. And it's like, okay, great. Awesome. It's good to get somebody on the other side of the fence, I think. And it does bring you down a little bit in that sense. I think, you know, you've said a few times, Mike, that he sensationalized things. And I haven't figured out if I'm glad he did that or if I'm upset that he did that. Because I feel like by him sensationalizing it, it gets the point across a little better. Like you can get the sense of this is the point he's trying to make in each step. But at the same time, I feel like it's exaggerated to the point of almost unbelievability. And I don't know if I should follow him or argue with him. Maybe that's what he wants. You know, Malcolm Gladwell tends to do that. So I don't know if that's the path that he's going down here. But I can say I'm grateful to have read this. I don't know if I'm going to recommend this one. I think it would have to be in very specific scenarios if I would say, you should read this. But that means I have to figure out how to rate this.
You do.
I'm going to put it, where am I going to put it? I'm going to put it at 3.5. That's where I'm going to put it. because I feel like there are some good tidbits out of here. Obviously, I've got some action items out of it. It's good to have gone through, but I have so many things I feel like I'm arguing with that I just don't think it would be as helpful unless you have a lot of the history in the books that we have read. Like, if you've read as many books as we have in the same genre, I feel like this would be a good one just as a, you know, something different. You know, it's not contributing to the echo chamber, but if you're still like on the edge of getting into reading more, I would stay away from this. I don't think it would be as helpful. That's just my opinion though. What are your thoughts, Mike?
I agree with you. And I think it's a bit of a shame because there is definitely room for a book that says you don't have to go all Gary V and not to go as far the other way as he did. It's kind of like, here's what everybody is saying. There's this uneasy feeling that I get when I follow these people. So I am just going to come up with the biggest sensationalist anti-message I can. You know, like I'm thinking right now of like New York Times article recently, which I agree with this, but the reason that it's popular is because of the headline, I guarantee you. It's like, stop trying to be productive during the coronavirus. And the basic point is that you're not going to be as effective as you normally are because we're all trying to figure out a new normal. And I agree with that, but that's not as enticing as, hey, productivity sucks, right? It's not going to get as many clicks.
Right.
And I feel like that's the approach that he took with this book. And I feel like that's a bit of a shame because I feel like I don't agree 100% with Gary Vee, Tony Robbins, all those types of people. I definitely don't agree 100% with the message in this book. But I, because he's so far the other way, I feel like I have to pick one side of the fence that I lean more towards. And I find myself going back to the stuff that I despised at the beginning with this description of the Tony Robbins event.
Sure.
And saying, oh, maybe there's elements of that which are good. Because there are elements of that that are good. There's elements of this that are good too. But by taking such a strong sensationalist approach, I feel like he's forcing you to pick a camp to be in. And I think there's definitely room in the middle for, actually, this is the way to do this, where you kind of sit in the middle and you take pieces of this and pieces of that and you combine it. That's not going to probably sell as many copies. So I get why. That's why you didn't take that approach. But yeah, I agree with you that this isn't the type of thing that you would recommend. Because it's so far the other way that I would be worried if I recommended this to somebody and they read it, they'd be like, oh, well, you agree with all of this stoicism stuff and all of this thinking about death stuff. And some of it, yeah, but not the majority of it and not the way that he presents it. And I'm not going to be there to defend myself.
Right,
so
right.
I'm not going to tell you that, hey, you should read this. That being said, there is some good stuff in here. I picked out some good stuff. I think there's elements of truth to a lot of this stuff, but you do have to dig in order to get them. His original point about how you try to find a system, you try to read a book and it solves all your problems. This isn't going to solve all your problems either. This kind of did the opposite of what it promised to do in the first chapter, I think, because he was basically saying that this is what you've been trying. It's not going to work. So you got to go the other way. And I feel like I went the other way by reading this book and I'm like, this just feels weird. I don't want to stay here either. So I'm going to put it at 3.0 because I do think, like I said, there's some good stuff here. I feel like any one of these chapters could have been an entire book and there are entire books written on this stuff. I feel like reading this and thinking you understand stoicism, for example, is dangerous. Same thing with Buddhism and goal setting and sure. Memento Mori and any of these things. So I really find myself, the real issue I have with this book, I think, is just the fact that it tries to combine a whole bunch of things and it doesn't do it in a very fair way, I think. But if you want a surface level book that is contrary to all of the Cult of Optimism stuff, then it's not a bad read.
All right. You should know that the next book on the list I actually have bought twice now.
Really?
Yeah, it was not intentional either.
All right. You're welcome, Ryder Carroll. The next book is The Bullet Journal Method by Ryder Carroll, who he's got a fascinating story. He made the rounds on the podcast when this was released. He kind of developed the bullet journal method as a response to ADD, ADHD, I forget specifically, but basically he was trying to find something that would work for him, created this analog system that has kind of blown up now. And so we are going to be talking about bullet journaling. I'm really excited about this. I find myself doing more and more with my paper and pen, especially now that I'm home all the time. That just feels really good to slow down and do all my time blocking that way. And I think this is going to be a fun one.
It warms my heart that you're excited about using pen and paper, Mike. But
it's true.
The story here is that I purchased this book and it was delivered, and it just, the package just didn't seem right. So when I opened it, I discovered none other than Little Red Riding Hood inside this package.
Not the same at all.
The distributor had sent me the wrong book. It's not exactly the same. You know, it differs in chapter two. You know, that it wasn't what I was after. I contacted them. They refunded me. They told me it's
the
not
big
worth
bad wolf
back.
Is Google.
I know, totally. So they told me it wasn't worth sending back. Like, the book was, I don't know, 75 cents or something like that. It's not even worth shipping. So they're like, just keep it. Like, okay. So they refunded me. I bought the book again and I just picked it up today. I was ready to read it about 3 days ago, but I just received it today and I'm excited to go through it because I have been like on the edge of bullet journaling for a while. My ADD has gotten a lot worse since all of my health stuff has gone on, which is kind of weird and apparently normal. I don't know. That's weird. I learned that when you're starting to come off of a mold infection, like whenever you treat that, if you have ADD, it can get worse. It's so weird to me. But anyway, I have to work through that. All that to say, I just went on a rabbit trail. The bullet journal method is next. Following that, we have Nudge by Richard Taller. Taller? I don't know how I say it. I'm going to say Taller. I like Taller.
All right.
I forget the tagline on it. I have totally spaced on what it's about, but Nudge is next.
All right. And then the other one that we added after that, because it was a gap book that I am just having trouble reading, is Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg. So if you want to stock up in preparation for the next several episodes, those are the next three books that we will be covering.
Awesome. Got a gap book this time?
No gap books.
You don't? I do.
Really? Okay.
I do. I don't know how I did, but I did. Well, I know how I did. I picked a really short one. It is the... I got to get it out here. It's an illustrated book of bad arguments.
Okay.
It's really entertaining. It talks through... It sounds silly, but it talks through things like a straw man argument. Like that type of thing. Like, what is that? And how do people use it? Like, whenever people are discussing something and making a point or arguing something, they tend to like force you to choose a camp, one side or the other, when there is a middle road, like that sort of thing. That's a bad argument in their definition. It's fascinating. Really interesting to go through. I would recommend that one. It's short. There you go.
All right.
I have a gap book. Woohoo!
Nice job.
Yes. Absolutely. Now, that all said, something we would absolutely love, and I know a few people are doing it now, is if you would join us live for these shows. You know, everybody's doing live stuff right now. If you want to become a member so that you can listen to these live and engage with us on the chat while we're doing this, sometimes we alter things, what we're talking about, depending on what people are saying in the chat box. But if you want to do that, go to bookworm.fm/membership, and you can sign up. It's a $5 a month membership. You get access to the private members area of the forums. You can listen to us live. You get a special bookworm wallpaper. You get access to all of Mike's MindNode PDFs. So you get access to some really cool stuff. So if you haven't done that already, you can join us, bookworm.fm/membership.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks to the Premium Club members for supporting the show. And if you're reading along, pick up The Bullet Journal Method by Ryder Carroll, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.